Today's scripture reading is from the book of Job in the Old Testament, chapter 1, verses 1 to 3, and verses 13 to 21. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you."
While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised."
This is God's word.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. One of the things that's hit me periodically over the last 2 months is how I've never lived at a point in time where so many people simultaneously were suffering throughout the world. To be sure, some are suffering more than others, and our forms of suffering vary. But it's a unique moment in that the common language of humanity is suffering. Swiss philosopher and poet Henri Frédéric Amiel said, "You desire to know the art of living, my friend? It is contained in one phrase, make use of suffering." It's what we want to do in our new series, Faces of Affliction, Heralds of Hope. Each week, we're looking at different biblical figures from different time periods and walks of life, but they're all relatable to us because they suffered, and none more so than the poster boy of pain himself, Job. You and I can certainly benefit from sitting in a lecture hall, listening to a scholar speak from a standpoint of expertise about suffering. But far better is the learning experience when we actually sit at the feet of someone who has been there, who's been through it. And few people in the history of humanity have suffered as Job has. When you go to the book of Job, it's like you're in the graduate school of suffering, sitting at the feet of the doctor himself. There's so many lessons on suffering that help us make use of our pain and grow in the art of living. Let's look today at 3 of those lessons. First, a lesson of mystery. Second, a lesson of misery. And finally, a lesson of wonder. So first, a lesson of mystery. Well, Job is certainly one of the most famous figures of antiquity. In his day, he was also known as an extraordinary individual. God himself said he is blameless, which didn't mean he was perfect. It just meant he was a remarkable man. He was incredibly successful, but he didn't allow his success to go to his head. He wasn't full of himself. He was good to the core. Yet one day, inexplicably, his life fell apart. In rapid fire succession, he was hit from all sides. Financial ruin, all of his children were killed, and he was struck by intense suffering and pain physically. His reaction, Job arose, tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb and naked shall I return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." You might be thinking, wait, I thought you said this was relatable. I cannot relate to that reaction. That's not maybe how a lot of us would react. you might be able to identify more readily with Job's wife, who also was going through incredible trauma. She's looking at her husband and says, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." She's saying, "Are you kidding?" I mean, this is a much more raw response. Suffering, if it is anything, is mysterious in that we can't make sense of it oftentimes. Factor into that the existence of a God who is both completely in control and compassionate. And all of a sudden, the confusion has increased exponentially. Even trying to make sense of it can be a form of suffering, a metaphysical misery in and of itself. So how did Job come to that kind of reaction? When you say, well, maybe he knew why he was going through all this. Actually, he didn't. Curiously, as the reader, we have a little bit more information than Job. We learn that the evil one, Satan, confronted God and said, you know, that Job, you talk about how great he is. Well, of course he is. You've written him a blank check, but you remove his props and he will peel away from you immediately. Test him, God says. You say, well, wait a minute, that raises a whole nother series of questions, and I understand that. But see, you and I have very limited realms of knowledge when it comes to understanding our suffering. It is a mystery. We are finite creatures. We had a little bit more information than Job, but not a lot. It's sort of like we're a first-generation handheld calculator trying to download data from the most sophisticated supercomputer on the planet today. It's not going to go really well. We're not going to be able to get much out of that. And that's how it is for you and me. We are finite creatures trying to make sense of the infinite. And that means a great deal of mystery. And instead of allowing it to drive us away from God, which is very understandable, or to just leave us kind of in a spiritually numb state, what if it actually drove us to our knees? There's a song by the Irish rock band U2, Mysterious Ways, thinking about some of these things that you can't explain. To touch is to heal, to hurt is to steal. If you want to kiss the sky, you better learn how to kneel. Look, if we want to face suffering in a way where we're able to make use of it, where we're able to grow in the art of living, then what if it really began with us not shaking our fist at God, but falling down on our knees before him? Saying, God, I can't make sense of this. I don't understand. I can't put all the pieces of the puzzle of life together. Oh God, help me to make sense of it. Help me to make sense of you being utterly in control and compassionate at the same time. It's mysterious. And that's best processed before God on our knees. It's the first lesson, the lesson of mystery. The second is a lesson of misery. And it turns out it wasn't the immediate catastrophic suffering, but rather the chronic lingering pain that broke Job. The bulk of the book, the middle section, is taken up with the monotony of misery that becomes sort of his new normal. And you get this sense that while he's not running away from God, that he is reeling, trying to make sense of what he knows about this God who is great and compassionate in the midst of his suffering. The arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks in their poison. God's terrors are marshaled against me. Oh man, this is fairly dark stuff. And in his confusion, he is disturbed and he is trying to make sense of it. He cries out, he will not let me get my breath. He's like saying, come on, God, can you back down? It's like he's in the boxing ring being pummeled and the referee won't put a stop to it. You ever felt that way? Well, Job didn't have to go through this alone. He had a small group of friends who came to be with him. And, you know, I think there's few things in life that are worse than having to go through intense pain and suffering alone. It's one of the great tragedies, of course, of the coronavirus era that we're in. So many people throughout the world in hospital, in ICU, without friends and family. The only human beings that they're interacting with are these people that look like sort of in hazmat uniforms. So I was listening a couple of weeks ago to a podcast called Social Distance. It's a podcast of The Atlantic, interviewing a young woman, a Stanford fellow, who was in an ICU suffering from COVID-19, talking about her experience. Her name is F.T. Kola. Everyone I came in contact with went to incredible lengths, she said, to humanize the experience. The kind of care that was given to me by the doctors and nurses and hospital staff really humbled me. I kept thinking of it as a kind of radical love to care for someone you don't know, who's not related to you in these incredibly intimate ways, to care for them at great risk to yourself. It felt like the closest thing to grace that I've experienced. And it makes you so incredibly grateful for all in the healthcare profession, all the first responders who are so graciously caring for individuals who are infected right now. Well, this was not Job's experience with his friends, sadly. You've heard the expression, misery loves company. Job would probably be rolling his eyes saying, yeah, this company brought my misery. They magnified the misery. It's true, absolutely true, that social distance creates a sense of painful isolation. It is also true that relational dysfunctionality within social isolation can exacerbate that sense of isolation and feeling alone. And it raises the question, how can you and I be the kind of friend that doesn't magnify the misery, but is more like grace than anything that person has experienced before? When you look at Job's friends, you know, it's sort of a case study in how not to do it. I mean, the best thing they did was at first they just sat there. They went to be with him. That was right and healthy, to be present with people in their pain. But when they begin to talk is where they steer off course. They're religious people. They begin to sort of piously theologize and try to connect the dots. Job, you're suffering. Clearly, Job, you must have done something wrong. It wasn't the case. We already knew that he was a blameless man. It wasn't about Job's moral character. It's something else beyond Job's personal experience or character. And yet they made the mistake of trying to connect those dots. And as a result, they exhibited more like karma than the closest thing to grace that Job would have ever experienced, the furthest thing from it, as a matter of fact. And what you and I need to be are individuals like this woman described in the ICU, who are present, who are humanizing, who are there in the midst of people's pain. And Job didn't find that solace in his friends, but he did know one place to find it. In the midst of his turmoil, he cries out, Job 13:15, to God, though he slay me, I will hope in him. How do we make use of our suffering? It's in falling before God on our knees, appreciating mystery. It's a lesson of mystery. It's also this lesson of misery, that we need to find our hope in God and be to others that friend that more closely resembles grace than anything else they've experienced. But finally, it's a lesson in wonder. Let's think about that. So for the middle section of Job, the majority of the book of Job, It's Job going back and forth in conversation with these friends. Job, trying to come up for air, asking God to enter into the conversation, and he never does. But finally, towards the end of the book, God does enter into the conversation. He doesn't answer the why question. He doesn't tell Job the backstory about his conversation with the evil one. Maybe that's because Job didn't need that. What Job really needed, as it turned out, was to have his focus redirected and his soul expanded. And so when God does enter into the conversation, it's described as out of the storm, in a veritable blizzard of questions. It's like he's saying, Job, you need to brace yourself like a man, because I've got some questions that we've got to talk about. Were you there when I laid the foundation of the earth, for instance? Have you commanded the morning? Tell me, have the gates of death been revealed to you? Can you bind the constellations? You see what he's doing? He's redirecting Job's focus and turning it toward the greatness of who God is in all of his glory and all of his beauty. Because look, when we go through suffering, our natural default for most of us is to be consumed with our pain and suffering. And we turn inward. And when we do that, we become interior, in the interior being of ourselves, a very small person. We atrophy. What God is saying to Job is, fix your gaze instead upon the greatest being in all of the universe. And what it'll do is it will expand you. It will make you a greater person and put you in a far healthier place, a place of wonder. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. See, he was struck by God's beauty in the midst of his turmoil. Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things, here it is, too wonderful for me to know. That's what Job needed all along, was to be struck by the wonder of who God is. The storm of who he is and his greatness and glory. Now, it ought to provoke the question for us, well, why is it that Job wasn't utterly consumed by the storm of God's greatness and glory? And we do have a clue a little bit earlier in the book. In the midst of his turmoil, as he comes up for air, he gets a peek, a flicker of hope at one point in Job 19:25. I know my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth. What Job saw faintly, you and I see far more clearly in the New Testament, in the person of Jesus, you see. We see God not lecturing us as a scholar from the academia of heaven, but fully entering into our suffering and pain in the person of Jesus. In Jesus, God humanizes fully his greatness for us. We see the pinnacle of his radical love as he cares for us in such a way that should humble us and bring us to our knees, as Jesus himself went into the storm and was completely consumed by that ultimate storm on the cross for you and me. Tim Keller, reflecting on this, put it this way: Jesus Christ bowed his head into the greatest storm, the storm of divine justice, for us, so we can hear a voice of love from the holy God. That voice of love in Jesus to you and me: come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Jesus is saying, come to me. I am that safe place. I am that ultimate forever friend. How is it that you and I can make best use of our suffering? Fall on our knees before our great and glorious God. Fix our gaze upon him, realizing that in the mystery of his ways, though he controls everything, he is simultaneously compassionate. And flood your heart with the ultimate love of God for you in Jesus Christ. And while we may not have all of the questions answered this side of eternity, maybe, maybe that won't ultimately matter to us because we've discovered something far superior. As Job put it, something simply too wonderful to know.